you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The torch is lit, the flags are flying, the Olympics are underway. The world's best athletes stand skate-to-skate, ski-to-ski, toe-to-toe, battling to bring home the gold. People across the world watch the Olympics, cheering their heroes and counting their country's medals. I talked to Bob Ford earlier today from Salt Lake City. He's a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer covering the Games. I asked him what kind of start the Games are off to.
Organizationally, they're off to a very good start. Things seem to be running fairly smoothly. Only minor traffic problems and transportation delays, and then something of this magnitude, that's to be expected.
What's the mood inside the Games complex with all the security around?
More patience than one might suspect. The security checks are fairly laborious, and it takes a while to get through. Some of the spectators have been held up, and some of them have missed the start of some events. But generally, people are approaching it with the idea of pretty good humor, and that this is something they have to go through.
Do the athletes feel the security blanket as well, or are they fairly exempt from it once they're inside the lines, if you will?
Well, they go through exactly the same screens that everyone else does. And I've stood in line with some athletes at some other venues. And they, more than anybody, I think, appreciate the security measures that have been taken because, if there were targets or something like that, they would probably be as likely as anything else.
And what sports are drawing the most attention this year? Is it back to the glamour of the ice skating, or is it out on the mountainsides?
Well, almost all the events are sold out here, so judging by interest, there is a lot of it. The figure skating is always going to be the glamour, the celebrity event of the Winter Olympics. The downhill and the Super G and then the slalom events on the Alpine racing circuit are extremely popular, and none of that's changed. It's pretty much what you would expect.
Which American athletes are drawing the most attention, either for the performances they've given already or anticipated performances, Bob?
I would say that no athlete here is going to draw more attention than Michelle Kwan, the women's figure skater, and whether or not she can finally get her gold medal. Beyond that, I would say Bodie Miller, who's a gate skier for the United States and slalom specialist, is going to be getting a tremendous amount of attention. Those are two that I would pick out as far as the Americans go.
And how about the outside world, Bob? Does the shadow of 9/11 touch these Olympics, or does it seem fairly distant now that they're underway?
Well, obviously the tangible effect here is the security, and people understand why that's in place, and they understand the dangers that are out there. After the opening ceremony, when the 9/11 flag was brought into the stadium, and there was obviously a very sincere remembrance then, I would say that that has not been an overwhelming subject at the Games or something that people are focusing on.
We heard a little bit about protesters somewhere on the outskirts of the facility. What was that about?
There have been various little protests by various special interest groups. There was a group of religious fundamentalists, which in Utah is sort of a redundant term, who were upset that they were handing out condoms in the Olympic Village for the athletes to make use of. And there was a group that was protesting a rodeo that was held as part of the local arts festival that is sort of an adjunct to the Olympics, and animal rights people were protesting the rodeo. But generally, it's special interest groups, very narrow kind of thing, nothing that you would call a widespread protest of any one thing.
Is condom distribution new, or has this been around?
No, that's a fairly common practice for the last four or five Olympic Games, but especially since the coming of AIDS in the world and all over the globe, actually.
Yeah.
That more awareness was made of that. The last three or four Games, that's been fairly standard.
Bob Ford is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. I spoke with him earlier from Salt Lake City.
It's broken the spirit von der Linie to fire the ersten Olympiade neuer Zeitrechnung.
With those words, Adolf Hitler opened the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, Germany. Hitler was determined to make a huge splash with that Olympics. He wanted to show the world the power and strength of the Nazi state. Hitler made sure Germany's games were full of pomp. It was the first time the Olympic torch was lit, the first full-blown opening ceremony, and the first time the modern Olympics were used to make a political statement. But it wouldn't be the last. Since the inception of the modern Olympics more than a century ago, the games have been the stage for political statements large and small, violent and peaceful, from American athletes saluting black power on the medal stand in 1968 to the murder of 11 Israeli athletes by Palestinian terrorists during the 1972 games. Politics have invaded and some say infected the Olympics. The International Olympic Committee says the Olympic Games are about athletes competing pure and simple. They say political statements have no place in this celebration, but politics seem to creep in. Is it inevitable that politics find their voice in this international spectacle? Can the Olympics truly stand apart? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're joined this evening by Derek Holm. He's an Olympic historian and professor of political science at Alma College in Michigan. He joins us from Michigan. Good evening and welcome, Derek Holm.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
And Jack, you've got a gold medal winner up there in Vermont, I hear.
Oh, we do?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah,
well, there are so few people in the state, I should know who this is.
The Pony Express will be to your neck of the woods
in no time, Jack.
They'll
let me know pretty soon.
Derek Holm, we're looking at the political profile of the Olympics in the year 2002 against the backdrop of politics in Olympics that have preceded it. Give us a sense of the origins of the modern Olympics and what is it in their structure that makes them so want to be immune to politics, but then inevitably a forum for politics?
It's a wonderful question. And the founder of the modern Olympic Games, Baron Pierre de Coubertin, in the late 19th century, established the games really with two competing sets of goals, and that has been the problem for the modern Olympics. The first set of goals was to try and foster some kind of universal experience, an opportunity for the representatives of countries of the world to come together mm-hmm. in a peaceful forum. But the games were specifically structured so that the athletes would represent their countries. And we have now national symbols. We have a national flag, a national anthem. We have an unofficial medal count. And all of those national identifying kinds of characteristics are the thing that make the Olympic Games as political as they are. And the International Olympic Committee has always refused to do anything to in any way sever that relationship between the individual and their national country.
Has it ever been proposed? Have people imagined athletes who would come without reference to their nation of origin and compete simply as individuals?
Oh, it absolutely has. When you had the boycott movements in 1980, when the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Games, and then in 1984, when the Soviet Union boycotted the Los Angeles Games, there were lots of proposals to try to do away or to reduce the national sort of imagery, to talk about, there was talk about moving away from team sports. There was even talk about allowing individuals to compete simply as individuals.
We know the legend of the ancient Olympics is that athletes competed naked. It would just about take a naked bunch of athletes to keep flags out of this Olympics that we've come to know today.
I think that's absolutely right. And the International Olympic Committee understands that, and they understand the enormous popularity that the Olympics has is based, at least to a certain extent, on this identification of citizens with their country. People tune in to watch the Olympics. They love to see it in the United States. They love to see Americans win Olympic medals. If you watch the Canadian station, it's the same thing. And so people root for athletes representing their countries, and it's a very powerful tool for the Olympic movement.
But as you say, this was built into the modern Olympics from their inception, the notion that nations would be represented, their teams would be national teams. Was the hope that this would be a forum where nationalism would be sublimated somehow, that this would be sublimated instead of war, we'd have the Olympics? Or did they really think that somehow with all the flags and national teams, nationalism would be ameliorated by the Olympics?
I don't think they ever thought that. Again, the founder of the Olympic Games was a French national who was very upset with the French defeat in the Franco-Prussian War in the late 19th century.
He wanted to train strong French warriors.
He wanted to regain French national pride.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these two very different and competing impulses, one toward this international collection of athletes who are really representing an ideal, and one ideal, and the other being an opportunity for national representatives to compete against one another.
Given what a widely watched spectacle the Olympics has become, do you see it as politically exploited or as relatively exempt, Derek Holm?
I don't think it's exempt. I think clearly we have had many, many uses of politics. We had in 1968 a very powerful statement made by two American athletes on the Olympic stand as they were accepting their medals. There was a Black Power salute, and that was a demonstration that they sought to make, and it was a statement really to the international community that things were not acceptable for them from their perspective within the United States.
So
I'm sorry.
I'm just thinking back. There you had the U.S. black athletes saying things aren't all right here, and of course, things were not all right in Mexico at that time either. There had just been a bloody government crackdown on student demonstrations where perhaps hundreds of Mexican students were killed. Some have seen the U.S., the sharp American crackdown on these protesting black athletes as an expression of solidarity with the Mexican government when it was cracking down on its own student radicals.
Well, what's interesting about the Mexican situation is that the International Olympic Committee was very nervous and very upset because those student demonstrations occurred right before the Olympic Games, and there was at least an implicit message sent to the organizing committee and to the state of Mexico to get the protests under control before the Games started.
The opening ceremonies have come to be among the most widely watched portions of the Olympics. And isn't there a kind of irony there, Derek Holm, that the origin of this grand spectacle was in the Nazi Olympics?
It's very interesting. And Hitler clearly had a couple of goals. He wanted to, first of all, demonstrate, yes, that the Nazis were this powerful, efficient, well-organized machine, but he also wanted to present a certain kind of human face to the world to dispel concerns and anxiety that the international community had about what the Nazis were doing. The opening ceremony is a wonderful opportunity, and you're absolutely right. Nowadays, anywhere from 2 to 3 billion people watch the opening ceremony, and one of the reasons that it is so popular is because of the pageantry and the fact that you have national representatives in the Summer Games from almost 200 different countries marching at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, when you look out on that colorful field of athletes on the pageant and see it speckled with national flags, do you see a realm of pure sport or something else?
Something else. And, you know, the national element just simply gets more consolidated as the amateur element fades. I mean, that's what I'm struck with. Someone like me who follows this fitfully, when I'm reading today that stars from the NHL are going to staff the various countries' teams, these are paid professional athletes, it throws me for a loop. I mean, I remember 1960 when the U.S. hockey team, led by Jackie Curran, a Brookline fireman, played the Russians. And these guys, the Russians were practically pros, and our guys, who were amateurs, beat them. And it was like a triumph, not of America, but of just sort of, you know, sportsmanship. And in other words, you were celebrating something else, not just naked national merit. There was the amateur thing, the pure idealism of the athlete.
Derek Holm, what about that? What's the status of amateur versus all comers at the Olympics these days? We see an awful lot of professional athletes showing up there.
Right. The amateur thing is gone. The international federations who are responsible for controlling the individual sports have effectively phased out the requirement that athletes be amateurs. That really came about as a result of a great deal of concern expressed during the Cold War era about the professionalism of the East European countries, including the Soviet Union and the East Germans, and there was a sense that there simply wasn't a level playing field. And so what has happened is you've had really the elimination of the amateur ideal in many, many Olympic sports. It's not true of a lot of the non-headline sports, but the headline sports are really now being played by professionals.
Is there any going back on that, or are the amateur days gone forever?
I think they're gone forever.
Well, that's quite a big step, isn't it?
It is, and it's one that was resisted very, very much by some of the stalwarts of the Olympic movement in the mid-century. Particularly Avery Brundage was absolutely opposed to any infringement on the Olympic ideal, which he saw as one based on amateur athletes.
The Olympic athletes are on the snow, they're on the ice, and tonight we're talking about Olympic politics. It's a rich history. You can join our conversation. What do you root for at the Olympics? A flag? An ideal? An individual athlete? Do the Olympics promote world peace or nationalism or both? Or is it all about the athletes for you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sadly, in this imperfect world, the greater and the more important the Olympic Games become, the more they are open to commercial, political, and now criminal pressure.
Then IOC President Avery Brundage announcing that the 1972 Munich Games would go on despite the terrorist murders of Israeli athletes. It's been a long road since then. No more terrorism, but plenty of politics at the Olympics. Olympics boycotted in 1980 and in 1984. What do you see in the Olympic legacy today? Who do you root for? What do you root for at the Olympics? A flag, an ideal, an individual athlete? Do you see politics in the post-9/11 Salt Lake City Olympics, or have the Games somehow carved out a separate piece in our troubled world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Derek Holm. He's author of The Political Olympics, Moscow, Afghanistan, and the 1980 Boycott. He's a professor of political science at Alma College in Alma, Michigan. Derek Holm, there you heard the response in 1972, Avery Brundage saying that the Games would go on despite the murder of his 11 Israeli athletes. Then terrorism came right into the Olympics. Now terrorism is the backdrop to the Olympics. Have the organizers managed to fairly well insulate these Games against the trauma of the September 11th incidents, or do you feel it breathing out there in the Salt Lake City air?
Oh, I absolutely think you're right. It is the background against which the Olympics is being hosted. It's interesting to observe the behavior of President Bush at the Games. Bush, I think, has realized very much that the Games represent another opportunity, both a domestic opportunity and an international one, internationally to demonstrate to the world community that, in fact, things are going on and there's some sense of normalcy returning. To the domestic audience, I think it's a demonstration that America is not going to be cowed by terrorism. Bush was very effective in a certain sense at the opening ceremony. He, sitting with the American athletes, was, I think, a politically very astute move, and he understood that it was an opportunity both to demonstrate his support for the athletes and also to reinforce his perception that he is attuned with the American public and he's sensitive to their concerns. And so Bush used the opening ceremonies, I think, pretty effectively.
Derek Holm, the International Olympic Committee refused to have the famously tattered World Trade Center flag that was recovered from the scene of destruction in New York carried by the U.S. team proper in the Parade of Nations in the opening ceremony. What was behind that decision, and is it in line with Olympic prohibitions on politics over the years?
I think in a sense it was simply too overt a display of a political message, and they were afraid that it would become too much of a focus of the opening ceremonies. So I think that was why there was a compromise that was eventually reached. But I think what is particularly interesting is, in fact, that it became an issue, and it became an issue simply because of the structure of the Games themselves.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that the Games, as we've been talking about, are these competitions among political actors, among states. They are not competitions among athletes in a certain sense. And because of that, there is always an opportunity to inject some sort of a political message into what is going on at the Games. And clearly, this would have been a political message, and I think it was simply too overt for the IOC to accept.
Is the IOC, has it been consistent in its opposition to political to politics intruding on the Games? Do they have a hypocrisy-free line on this front, Derek Holm?
Absolutely not. They have been very interested in using politics when they perceived it to be to their advantage. One of the major goals of the IOC during the course of the 20th century was to try to create, ultimately, a universal Games, where you had essentially the entire international community participating. And they went to very great lengths to try to get the People's Republic of China in the Games, to get the two Germanys to compete when the Germanys were still divided, and ultimately to bring the developing world into the games. And they made an effort to do this with granting the 1968 games to Mexico City, and now with granting the 2008 games to Beijing. So one of their efforts has been universalism, and that has led them to make certain political decisions.
And you mentioned again, of course, how the medal count is always so closely watched. Many people can remember when that was indeed a kind of measure of the merit of the so-called the free world versus the communist world. What's being measured today by the medal count?
I think what's going to be very interesting to watch over the next 10 or 20 years is a new focus on the medal count between the United States and the PRC, People's Republic of China. Mm-hmm. They are clearly investing a very large amount of national resources into creating and developing a very powerful powerful Olympic team. And at least part of that effort is designed to demonstrate to the world, and particularly to the Western world, that China is a coming power. The Olympics has always been perceived to be one indication of international stature. And probably one of the best examples of this was the East German team. East Germany was a relatively small state. They put an enormous amount of effort into creating what ultimately became one of the top three athletic teams competing at the Olympic Games.
And, of course, Beijing will host the 2008 Summer Games after a huge effort on their part to secure that honor.
A huge effort, right.
That honor and that expense. Jack Beatty, is there a problem with looking at the Olympic Games in a nationalistic way? I mean, we root for our hometown teams, for our city and regional professional teams. Isn't the Olympics just that on a larger stage? Is there a downside? Is there something savage about rooting for the Americans when you're an American? Isn't that just, you know, showing the home team flag?
Yeah, I mean, and we're manipulated to do it by the television. I mean, according to the Wall Street Journal today, the NBC has been embarrassed that there were no figure skaters from the USA who looked like they were going to triumph. So they've been pushing a couple who are from Canada, and now they're saying, win the gold for North America.
Well, but what's really wrong with that?
Nothing. I mean, it's human. You know, we're divided into but it's at war with the universalist ideal of the Olympics, which seems to be, you know, one world, which seems to be, you know, the equality of peoples, which seems to be athletes of different races from different cultures joined together, a kind of microcosm of what we would like international relations to be like. And it's as if even within this temple that's supposed to be standing for universalism, we can't keep the tribalism out.
And yet, even in the temple, it's not about really equality. I mean, I don't know about you, Jack, but I am not equal to those mogul skiers out there or skaters or any of those other participants. Derek Holm, was there ever a real belief that this would be a vehicle for peace and world understanding, or was that always just kind of a gloss?
I don't think it was ever a gloss. I think that there has been and there was and there still is a very sincere hope that the Games can provide one opportunity for the world to come together and to just play. Mm-hmm. And that is really part of, it's a fundamental belief in the Olympic movement. The fact that there's this competing strain, I think, doesn't in any way negate the fact that you have this other very, very powerful impulse. And it's something that attracts people. You have people watching the downhill who wouldn't know a downhill from a hole in the head.
Right.
And they watch it at least partly because it's the Olympics. And the Olympics represent something to non-athletes that I think is part of – it's just a very strong human impulse to believe that for this moment in time there is something different about the world, even if people know, in fact, that's not true.
At its best, it is a very, very powerful and attractive symbol. There's no question about that. Listeners, what do you root for at the Olympics? A flag, an ideal, an individual athlete? Do you understand why the IOC did not want the World Trade Center flag carried in by the U.S. team in the opening ceremony's Parade of Nations? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rob is calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Good evening. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
You asked Jack earlier if there was something wrong with nationalism, and I just wanted to express my feelings. I don't think
Please.
There's anything at all with the nationalism. I think it's more patriotism than anything. And to say that flying the American flag or someone else flying their own country's flag is wrong or politically incorrect would be a very, very big mistake.
Yeah, well, that's just one of the questions that gets raised here. So you have no hesitation about jumping up and waving the flag and cheering for the American team. That's what it's about for you, Rob.
Absolutely not. I think that there's growing feelings in some parts of the country that being a patriot is politically incorrect. And I think it's our duty to be a patriot. And
so you see not only nationalism but patriotism here. And what about Derek Holmes' idea that originally, and even now, the Olympics are intended to stand for peace, for a kind of a fellowship of humankind? Do you see any contradiction, Rob, between that and the cheering for the home team?
No, I do not, because the Olympics is not only about the country. The Olympics is and should be mostly about the athletes. And I believe that the athletes are getting friendships with athletes from other countries that will last lifetimes, and they're coming together in ways that they would not be able to if it were not for the Olympics.
Rob, thanks a lot for your call. Derek Holm, the advent of global mass media means that everybody from Rob in Pennsylvania to, you know, somebody sitting in probably the Horn of Africa can watch these games. They seem, as you pointed out in the numbers earlier, they're tremendously popular. You know, whatever you think of the Olympics, they sell.
Oh, they absolutely sell. And one reason that the International Olympic Committee has had such a difficult time in trying to tone down the political character of the games is that it has become torn because it is, in a sense, become addicted to the amount of money that has been generated by television revenue. The Olympic Games, as we move into the post-boycott era, 1988, 1992, and so on, has become an enormous machine generating money for the International Olympic Committee, for the National Olympic Committees, and for the host cities. The Olympic Games didn't used to be a big moneymaker. If you look at Montreal in 1976, the city practically went bankrupt trying to host the Games.
Huh. And now the dollars pour in, at least to the television networks. Jack Beatty, do you think that is, well, it's a vehicle to take it to the world, certainly. Is there a downside?
Well, that's the way we get our communications. I mean, there's they just can't get around that. But I like what both Professor Holm and Rob were saying, that these games manage or at least try to fuse the Rob's patriotism or nationalism or whatever you want to call it with this sense of one world, and that they, however unwieldy the structure is, that they really try to do that. And so it's wrong to just see them in the one-eyed perspective as if the patriotic part is triumphing over the other part.
Mm-hmm.
Both things seem to be there, and I like that idea of the games as a kind of bastard ideal, if you will, but one that functions. To hear Mr. Holm.
That's a bastard that skis there, Jack. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
Just a quick reflection. I think one of your panelists had earlier noted that there is no going back from the professional nature of the Olympics.
It seems not. The amateur era seems to have passed from us.
Yeah. So just a reflection, maybe even a question on that. My cousins of the Shea family, which have gotten a lot of press in recent weeks, particularly the tragedy of Jack Shea, who's 91 years old, was the oldest living Olympian who was just killed in a car crash.
Yes.
And his grandson, in fact, took the Olympic oath on behalf of all the athletes in the opening ceremony.
So you've got a prominent family in the Olympics. What's the view from that angle, Mike?
Well, until his dying day, he would go to great pains to explain to everybody what the Olympic ideal was all about. He was, in a sense, the perfect ambassador for the Olympic movement. And he would always harp on not only the importance of sportsmanship in the contest, but also the importance of and the amateur nature of the Olympics. I do think that I think your panelist was right on about the motivations for our having turned the tables. Clearly, you had Soviet and Eastern Bloc countries that had national teams that were routing our spry young college kids who were trying to put up a decent fight.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the reason, the motivation for that has since crumbled to a great degree. And while I don't expect anything out of the IOC, because certainly it's a business and it's become a huge business, I think it's a shame and a poor reflection on us that we're not able to muster the collective political will, and that's exactly what it would take, to bring the Olympics back to where they deserve to be. Because what we have now is...
And by that you mean back into the hands of amateurs.
Well, back into the hands of amateurs as contestants. Let the corporate interests continue to do what they will, because it's a huge event. But I think it's a shame that even among our panelists, we're willing to concede this point.
Mike, you're carrying that torch high, and we're happy to hear the Shea family checking in. And you make a good point, Derek Holm. What about it? Do we just write off the amateur era? Is there any way in which amateurs can they still compete? Is everybody sponsored by Visa or McDonald's these days?
No, they're not. And what's funny is you have the feeling that they are, because most of the coverage that you see on the various network organizations focuses on what we would consider to be the glamour sports.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots and lots of competitors who never make it on television in the less glamorous sports, and you do have amateur athletes competing in those venues.
What percentage would you say today in the Winter Olympics?
Probably a fairly high percentage. I wouldn't.
More than half?
I would say probably more than half. Would be of competing in events that other people just simply don't care that much about, and they're not going to attract corporate sponsorship, and that's probably true as well in the Summer Games. And so I think it's not accurate to say that in fact amateurism is dead and the amateur ideal is over. I think that's true for the headline sports, and you will never go back from that.
I may have misspoken there. Does having a corporate sponsor mean you're not an amateur, or is it simply that you don't play the sport professionally?
Well, when I consider what it means to be a professional, it means that you are deriving some kind of significant revenue from what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of the sports, and we've seen a tremendous explosion in the number of sports now being contested, there are probably, and there's somewhere in the neighborhood of twice as many Olympic winter sports being played at Salt Lake as there were 20 years ago. As we have more and more sports, and we have lots of sports that are not headline sports, we still have room for the amateur ideal in the Olympics. It's simply something that doesn't get much coverage.
We're talking with Derek Holm. He's professor of political science at Alma College in Alma, Michigan, and author of The Political Olympics, Moscow, Afghanistan, and the 1980 Boycott. The Olympic politics are our question tonight. What do you root for at the Olympics? A flag, an ideal, or an individual athlete? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking tonight about the politics that run in, around, and through the Olympics, summer, winter, any season's Olympics. There's a history that goes way back, and we're looking at what it means right now about the political surround of the Olympics post 9/11, about Olympics in a world that's increasingly globalized and certainly wired for mass media broadcast around the world. Do you see politics in the post 9/11 Salt Lake City Olympics, or have the games managed to carve out a separate piece in our troubled world? What are you rooting for in Salt Lake City? And are the Olympics uplifting for you? Are they rocking your world? Are they turning you on? Are you into the sport there? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined on the line by Seamus, and if I'm not wrong, this is Seamus Mallon. Good evening and welcome.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for calling in.
Good. Well, thank you for taking my call. As you know, I'm primarily a soccer commentator, but I have been representing NBC at three Olympic Games in Seoul, Barcelona, and Atlanta.
So you know a thing or two about watching the Olympics.
About that, but that's not really what I'm calling. I'm calling because I've also been lucky enough to be in Greece, and I visited the origin of the Games in Olympia itself, and it's a terrific experience if anybody ever gets a chance to go there. But
what do you see there, Seamus? Can you still see the original, I don't know, facility or grounds?
Yes, you can still see a stadium. In fact, you can even run in the stadium, which I did, by the way. There was a wind against me, so my time wasn't the best, but nevertheless.
Did you take your clothes off and run in the moonlight, Seamus?
But I will tell you this, that there are two things that struck me there. One is that to think that even in the early days of the Olympic Games that these athletes competed for themselves and only for themselves is a nonsense.
Sure.
Because, in fact, they represented their areas and they were supported by the power structure of those areas to get them to these games.
Isn't that part of sport, Seamus? I mean, athletes run for the cheer of the crowd and for the adoration of their school, town, nation. Isn't that a piece of
it? That's right. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's when it goes over the top that we all have to get very, very concerned about it. But let me just give you a second aside here. I think it's really quite revealing. When you're outside the stadium in Olympia, there are statues there. And naturally, we thought when we first went there, these are statues of famous champions, but they're not. They're champions. There are statues of people who betrayed the games by cheating.
So they were held up for derision in stone?
Held up for derision by having statues erected to them of their names and where they came from, to remind everybody that these were people who let everybody down.
Fame and infamy, how thin the line between them can be.
It's a terrific lesson, frankly.
Seamus, when you look at the Olympics today, are you heartened by the direction they're going in? We see a lot of young people just competing their hearts out in Salt Lake City.
Well, I think you see, the Winter Games somehow picked me up an awful lot. I don't know quite what it is, because it seems like the amateur spirit fills a little bit more naturally into those games than it does into the somewhat more overblown summer games in many ways. I was in Barcelona and Atlanta when the Dream Team was there, and frankly, it was such a bore.
This is the U.S. professional basketball team.
Right. I mean, really, it was just a tedious bore with those characters. They did not belong there. It was nonsense to have them there.
But they're the world's best. Why not send them?
But they're, you know, they're millionaires in the game. They're such a total step away from what the games are all about. I somehow feel that a lot of the fresh-faced kids you see here, they may be on getting some support from sponsors and so forth in the Winter Games, but there's something that resonates a little bit more about their competitiveness than the somewhat spoiled pros that we have in the big games of basketball and ice hockey. Mm.
Seamus Mallon, thanks so much for joining our conversation.
Okay.
Appreciate your calling in. I want to talk, Derek Holm, about the political tenor of these games. But before we do, let's listen back for just a minute to 1968. This is Tommy Smith, one of the two Black Power Salute U.S. Athletes who raised their fists in protest on the medal stands in Mexico City.
Tommy, can you tell us the significance of the black glove on the right hand and the black socks that you've been wearing?
Black glove represents Black America, and so does the black socks. I'm proud to be a black man, and all my people back home know that it's very significant.
Tommy Smith, 1968, in Mexico City with the Black Power Salute. And Derek Holm, today we're told in our opening interview with Bob Ford of the Philadelphia Inquirer that the two small protests that caught his eye were against condoms and rodeo. have we lost a political context here? Have we, in fact, come closer to the ideal of a separate peace being established for the Olympics? Or is there something wafting through here that just isn't so obvious?
Well, I don't think we clearly have lost anything relating to the politics of the Games. I think the extraordinary security at the Games, they're spending approximately $300 million on security. You think about the enormous change from 30 years ago when the terrorists jumped over a little chain-link fence and were able to infiltrate the village. Things have simply changed, and I think that is what has really changed the nature of this Olympic Games. And we also have to remember that this is the Winter Olympic Games. It's simply not on the magnitude of the Summer Games. We have about a third the number of countries competing and about a quarter the number of athletes, and it's simply not the global affair that the Summer Games is.
I guess in a sense, the very existence of that division-sized security force is a huge political statement.
That is a political,
in itself.
Exactly. That is a political statement, and it has, the Games changed fundamentally after 1972. The 1976 Games in Montreal, we saw a qualitative increase in security. We saw a fundamental change in the focus of the organizing committee. We saw another step-level kind of change as a result of 9/11.
Let's try to get one more very quick call. Sharon, you're on the air.
Yeah, Yes, hello.
Hi.
I just want to make a quick comment about the media coverage of the games and how it sort of frames the games for people, especially in this country.
Do you like it or not?
I hate it.
And what about
it, Sharon? This year is better than last year. One of the things my husband and I love to do is watch the opening parade.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the few chances we get to see people from other countries without disasters happening around.
Mm-hmm.
And
they look pretty good when they're Olympic athletes, don't they?
Oh, well, definitely. But we enjoy the costumes, we enjoy the pageantry, we enjoy the spontaneous symbolism, for example, of the two Koreas marching together.
But the media brings you that, so what's the problem?
The problem is the voiceovers. We have a couple of announcers who insist on cutting away for commercials, although this year they did bring back the countries that were missed in flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
They did not do that last year, however, and they got a lot of flack for it. But the trivialization of these countries, I mean, the stupid things that we hear during the wonderful opening ceremonies, like how many sequins are on a costume.
Sharon, we've got to go with that observation. Our time's running down. But Derek Holm, last thought off of Sharon's complaint about the media coverage. What do you think? Fairly good, or are we lost in sequins?
Well, I think the media is always going to give the audience what it's looking for, and I think that NBC has been doing that. I think they've tried self-consciously not to be as overtly nationalistic as they have been in the past.
Does it look different if you watch it on the broadcast network of a different nation?
It looks absolutely different. I've been watching it just to see how it's being covered in Canada, and the Canadians approach it in a certain way very differently, and in another way very, very much the same. They focus on the Canadians. They focus on which Canadians are doing well or poorly or so on. And this is something that you simply would expect from any national network.
All depends who's holding the camera. Derek Holm is author of The Political Olympics, Moscow, Afghanistan, and the 1980 Boycott. Derek Holm, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, last thoughts. Are you turning your set on to catch the latest ski jump?
The latest profundity from Bob Costas. no, I'll turn it on later. I just wonder if we'll ever see anything like the end of the 1924 games shown in Chariots of Fire. And the hero of that game, those games, an Englishman, when he died, the headline read, "All Scotland mourned." Can't imagine that happening now.
And still there's a lot of passion. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The United States may have the largest number of athletes competing in Salt Lake City, 211 to be exact, but that doesn't guarantee they'll take home the most medals. In fact, our next guest says Germany will. But he's got an odd sort of measure. Dan Johnson says forget about the athletes' muscle size and training regimes. Instead, he says look at their home countries, look at the per capita income, look at the type of government, the type of governing system. That will tell you who takes home the gold. Dan Johnson is an economics professor at Wellesley College in Massachusetts and co-author of the study A Tale of Two Seasons, Participation and Medal Counts at the Summer and Winter Games. I asked him to explain his thesis.
Well, the thesis is that we can use economic and political variables to describe relationships between those variables and Olympic performance. Not only how many participants come per nation, but also how those participants fare once they arrive at the Games.
I mean, you can look at countries' economic and political systems or health and predict the medal count?
Yeah, that's the general idea. Our goal wasn't so much prediction, although that's kind of the fun conclusion of the analysis, but it was to look at the actual underlying relationships. That is, to explain why it is that Kenya wins so many fewer medals every year than, for example, Great Britain.
So have you tested your thesis?
We did this analysis, finding relationships between variables, in the summer of 2000, and then made predictions for the Sydney Games. What we found was that our predictions of both participation by nation and then medal counts by nation had a correlation with the actual results of the Games of 0.95. That is, we're 95% on the mark.
And what were the factors that went into your projection of how many athletes countries would send and how well they would do?
As our primary variables, we used income per capita, geography, that is, climate variables and distance to the hosting nation. We use the fact of whether it's the home nation or a neighbor country, and therefore transportation issues. We looked at population, and then the other big variable that we included was political structure.
By your analysis, what's the optimal profile of a country that wants to show up and win a lot of medals?
If countries were, at their own whim, able to sort of design their political economic structure in order to win medals, what you'd want to be is big, rich, and then have a communist structure so that your athletes, once they arrive, do really well.
We understand big because you have a large number of people to draw on. We understand rich because it takes money to train and be exempt from economic demands. How does the communist or socialist structure come into supporting a high medal count?
We actually found that communist or single-party structures don't send more athletes to the games than one would expect from their other variables. But once there, the athletes perform much better than you would expect. We're guessing that it has something to do with either the selection process, that they have a more centralized selection process to pick out truly the best athletes, train them centrally, and therefore sort of maximize the economies of scale that go along with sending athletes in the first place. And then second of all, there's sort of a follow-on or a legacy that's left by that. Once you have great Olympic athletes in one year, those can turn into trainers and coaches for the next generation.
So in this profile, the United States would actually be at some disadvantage.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, in the Winter Games in particular, the U.S. is at a bit of a disadvantage. Traditionally, it's actually smaller nations that do better in the Winter Games as opposed to in the Summer Games. Population is a big advantage.
So given your factors then, your scientific formula for determining medal outcomes, what are you projecting for the Salt Lake City medal count?
Well, our official predictions, if you run straight by the numbers,
okay,
are that Germany will actually top the medal podium the most times, 31 medals for Germany, which is just slightly then higher than their last Winter Olympic performance. They had 29 medals in Nagano. Second, after them will be Russia, just squeaking out the U.S. and Norway. Russia with 21 medals and the U.S. and Norway tied at 20.
Are you feeling confident?
We are. We hesitate to put that prediction forward as the primary motivation of the paper. The real reason that we did the paper was to look at the playing field. Is it level? Why is it that African nations win so few medals? Okay, we know in the Winter Games it's because there really isn't that much snow in Africa, so there isn't much time to train. But we were looking both summer and winter to see, is there something about the Olympic structure that allows certain countries to excel and other countries not with those advantages?
So, and this may be asking you to step out of your scientific role for a moment, but what insight do you take away from this?
We must remember first and foremost that the Olympics are about athletic excellence. And optimally, what we would like to do is have an international athletic regime that would allow all people from all backgrounds, all cultures, all nations, to have sort of equal access to that ability to participate and to excel.
But that requires making everyone equally rich, for starters.
Absolutely. And equal access to training, equal access to climate zones and all that sort of stuff. Of course, that's never going to happen. But what this paper hopefully points out is the results of those inequities. We know they're there, but how do they impact the Olympic medal count?
In that sense, it's just another indicator of national health, if you turn it around and look at the other way. The fewer medals you're winning, the less well-off you likely are as a nation.
Yeah. In fact, if you flip that on its head or on its side a little bit, you could treat it as an indicator of athletic health. If you take actual medal counts and compare them to our predictions, if your athletes do better than we predict, then it means that you're doing something in your nation that brings you above the average performance that would be expected.
Are you afraid that your 95% accuracy in projecting medal counts may take the suspense out of the Olympics, Dan Johnson?
Absolutely not. In fact, I'm watching them avidly. I'm almost cheering that our predictions are wrong, because I don't like that uncertainty to be taken out. The goal of the analysis is to show the broad trend, not to predict the individual athletes and how well they're going to do. I'm always cheering for the underdog and the surprise winner.
Dan Johnson is an economics professor at Wellesley College in Massachusetts and co-author of the study A Tale of Two Seasons, Participation and Medal Counts at the Summer and Winter Games. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.